Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we sat down with Dr. Ajay Gupta, director of the tuberous sclerosis program at Cleveland Clinic, who discussed recently published research that used an unsupervised clustering to group over 900 patients with tuberous sclerosis complex. He spoke about the four clusters he and his colleagues landed on, how each of them differ, and how they may be able to help with treatment individualization and selection in future clinical trials. Gupta, who also serves as a professor of neurology, spoke on the overlap in these clusters, as well as some of the variant-specific data that helped reinforce these categories. Let's dive in.
So far in tuberous sclerosis complex, there have been few studies on genotype-phenotype correlation. I would say a small percentage of those, maybe couple or three, are larger cohorts into 100 or 200 patients. And basically, thus far, what we have done is we took all the patients, their genotype information, the genetic mutation, and then correlated with their phenotypic information or their tuberous sclerosis signs and symptoms. In this study, we did three things which were different. And the reason we did it, we wanted to take a deep dive in this genotype-phenotype correlation. And that was the propelling force for us to say, hey, rather than taking a genotype and going to phenotype, can we take a large cohort of phenotype and then go back and see what deep genotype information can we get based on their phenotype?
That's very, very interesting to say the least. And like you said, there really hasn't been a lot of studies that have genotyped or phenotyped patients, which is why it kind of was an interest on our end. So, you know, for our clinical audience, talk a little bit about the four different clusters that we observed in this study. What sets of each other apart from each other, and how did we get there in the first place?
Well, before I go there, let me tell you what was the difference or innovative aspect of this study. The first was that we were lucky to have a large cohort of patients which are in the tuberous sclerosis natural history database. I'm sure many people don't know what this is, but in 2006, with the help of Tuberous Sclerosis Alliance and the initial funding from Department of Defense, a database to study the natural history of tuberous sclerosis was launched. Over time, it recruited a TSC clinical network of many, many people like myself or geneticists or neurologists who began contributing to this database. And then over time, this database has over 2,000 patients. I don't know what the number is right now, but when we analyze, it has over 2,000 patients. And the beauty is that these are all patients who have confirmed tuberous sclerosis diagnosis clinically and, in most respects, genetically. So we were very lucky to have access to that. So we took this large cohort of patients who are very well phenotyped because they have been studied every year. What is happening to them over their lifetime, beginning from the day they were diagnosed. So that information is hard to come by. So what we did is we took this cohort and we selected 29 phenotypic characteristics of brain, skin, kidney, and other things. For example, in brain, it could be epilepsy, it could be tumor, it could be autism, it could be intellectual disability, and so on. And we just took this information and did what we call as an unbiased, unsupervised clustering analysis, which means like, what are the different clusters that come out of this 900 some patients? And after that clustering, we went and looked at their genotype and saw which type of which cluster was associated with which gene mutation or which exon or which gene, and kind of got some good signals to suggest that if you do this approach, you get very interesting results. Now, you're asking me about four clusters. So what we found is that of these 900 plus patients, by doing an analysis, and this analysis is detailed in the paper, how we actually did the unsupervised and unbiased analysis and how we made sure that age is not biased in this data set. What we found is that there were four clusters, almost equal in frequency. In cluster one, it was the cluster where people are or patients are more prone to get brain tumor and kidney tumor. So it's a tumor cluster. If you are in that cluster, you had very high frequency of brain tumor and renal tumor. In cluster two, we found this was a cluster where you're likely to become very sick as a baby, as an infant, with what we call as epileptic spasm or West syndrome, which is one of the severe form of epilepsy, also called as epileptic encephalopathy, because it's really, really terrible disease. If you are in cluster three, you have a higher likelihood of neurodevelopmental disorders, a diagnosis of autism, intellectual disability, learning disability, okay, and also a higher risk of epilepsy or various forms, not necessarily infantile spasm. You may have infantile spasm, but you're likely to have other epilepsies. And in cluster four, which is very interesting, was some lucky people who really had a very mild disease. And either they were diagnosed because late in life or because they have a child who was severely affected. And what they really had was just little few skin spots, a history of focal seizures, which were relatively well controlled or easily controlled, but nothing else. No tumor, no cognitive difficulties, or if they were very mild, undiagnosed, things like that. So these are the four clusters that we came up, which were purely driven by clinical phenotype or by clinical assessment.
One of the things that kind of stuck out to me when I was reading your research was kind of the associations with variant location in specific protein domains. So, you know, you guys sort of noticed that variants affecting the rho domain of TSC1 or exons 5 to 2 were significantly more found in cluster 1 and significantly less found in cluster 2, or cluster 4. So talk a little bit more about this specific part of the analysis and just some of the impact of these findings specifically.
That's exactly right. Then we took each cluster, and when we looked at, hey, where are these mutations in cluster one? Is it TSC1 gene, TSC2 gene? If they were in that gene, which exons are involved? What type of mutations these are? Are these frame shift? Are these stop codons? Are these missense and so on? And if you look at the paper, you can see more details, but we did have some signals both ways. So we had signals in the way that if you have cluster one, just like you're saying, if you have a cluster one, you have a very high likelihood that your mutation is going to be in TSC1 rho domain exon 5 to 12 compared to, let's say, other clusters. We also did the signal the other way. For example, if you have a cluster one, you are least likely to have mutations in these exons of these genes. Do you follow me? And I think this information certainly need validation in a larger cohort, but it helps us both ways to make a genotype-phenotype analysis. So, for example, if you have a patient with a mutation in TSC1, rho domain 5 to 12 exons, this patient has a very high likelihood of developing tumors in the future in the brain or the kidney. Now, if that is the thing, and we know it doesn't usually, these things do not come up until late in life. For example, a good time for the brain tumor to begin appearing would be sometime preteen and teen and young adult. For kidneys, it could be late 30s or 40s. So these disease manifestations do come late. But if you know this patient is prone to those conditions, you could certainly take steps to be more aggressive in your surveillance, which means conducting scans, looking for symptoms, and you could be more proactive in using medications appropriately to prevent these conditions to give rise to acute symptoms or complication. Same is true in another cluster. This was just an example. Same is true in the cluster two, where we know that this patient is very likely to develop West syndrome, or cluster three, we know this patient is very likely to develop cognitive issues. And we definitely know now, we can say that if you identify patients' epilepsy in the early stage, if you are able to treat them early, not just treat, but effectively remit their seizures early or epilepsy early, you can help bend their trajectory of cognitive development, better quality of life in the long run. And I think that's the message that everybody needs to get: early diagnosis of epilepsy and early and effective treatment. And we know we have effective treatment for tuberous sclerosis-related epilepsy now, which we didn't have, you know, many, many years ago. But now we know which drug works, which doesn't. We know how to follow these kids. And I think it makes a difference in their long span of life. And we have shown, our work has also earlier shown that if you have effective control of seizures early, and I'm sure I know other people have also shown this, you have a better cognition preservation of your, cognitive potential, better learning, better quality of life, better psychosocial adjustments in long term.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Gupta to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, on May 5th, Capricor Therapeutics announced it completed a mid-cycle review meeting with the FDA over its BLA seeking full approval for deramiocel, an investigational cell therapy for patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy cardiomyopathy. During the meeting, the agency stated no significant deficiencies had been identified and that the PDUFA date of August 31st remains on track. Next, on May 9th, the FDA granted Regenerative Medicine Advanced Therapy designation to Mira GTX's AAV-GAD, an investigational gene therapy in development for Parkinson's disease. The treatment, which aims to restore proper brain circuit function, is administered through a one-time minimally invasive fusion using Mira GTX's proprietary device, which delivers a small amount of the therapy directly into the subthalamic nucleus, a critical brain region involved in movement control. And lastly, on May 12th, final data from the Phase 1b pilot study showed that investigational MAAT033, an oral microbiome ecosystem therapy, was safe and resulted in slower rate of disease progression in patients with ALS. According to Matt Pharma, the manufacturers, these data will be used to provide insights on the target population for a future Phase 2 study. For more information about these stories, head to neurologylive.com, or you can check out the corresponding link in the show notes. And now, back to our conversation with Dr. Gupta.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, it's awesome that we're at least having the conversations about even preventing some of these complications from even happening. Like you said, we still need a little bit of validation from some of these smaller groups, but, you know, to even kind of potentially exclude some of, you know, another prognosis or another, you know, potential pathway, and maybe say, hey, this is a patient who might be in this first cluster. This is how we might want to, you know, sort of attack the treatment plan for this patient and maybe get ahead of things. Like you mentioned, kind of those preventive options. I think it's really, really awesome to have those conversations, to say the least. I'm also curious from your perspective, Dr. Gupta, you know, like you said, this still needs a little bit more validation, but are there any, from a clinician standpoint, when looking at these different clusters, are there any symptoms or parts about each cluster that may overlap with each other? And also, how do we potentially differentiate some of the overlap that we see? Because obviously, every patient might have a little bit of something and then a little bit of something else. So how do we kind of differentiate some of that overlap a little bit?
That's a very good point. Tuberous sclerosis is such a variable condition. When we do this cluster analysis, these are not exclusive cluster. It doesn't mean if you have cluster 2, you cannot have brain tumor and vice versa. We know that this condition can still have very many manifestations. It's also possible that a child might start in cluster 2 and end up in cluster 1 or something like that. We don't know. So I think we have to be careful not to predict the disease trajectory based on this cluster analysis. I think what we are saying is that it's a very useful project that we did in terms of knowing which cluster your patient is landing as you are seeing the patient, both phenotypically and genotypically. And then based on what our knowledge of current state is, what you can foresee as a likelihood of these patients developing tumors, bad epilepsy, or cognitive difficulties. But certainly I'm hoping that when there are larger studies, larger sample size, that this will replicate, not just replicate, but perhaps be refined, both phenotypically and genotypically. I think the current state is that we don't know which patient is prone to what, but this project is the beginning of that sort of thinking to really offer a patient counseling, preventive strategies, as well as early treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, this is not the be-all, end-all, but at least laying some of the groundwork. And who knows, maybe some people might take, you know, your specific clusters and look at one specific cluster or not in more detailed research going down the road from now. There's a lot of different things that we can kind of expand from it. Dr. Gupta, I appreciate you taking some time out of your day. Last question for you. This is kind of a big question, but, you know, talk a little bit about what some of the implications are for a study like this on specifically treatment and research going forward.
I believe that from current state of the art, if you are aware of your patient's genotype and phenotype, it gives you an opportunity to select which patients you would subject to surveillance more often and in what way, and which patients you can wait on because you know their risk of developing any complication is low. For example, if your patient is cluster 1 and has a genotype in TSC1 rho domain exon 5 to 12, you probably want to be more vigilant about their brain tumors and kidney tumors because they may come on and be silent for a long time. And perhaps these are patients that you will screen more often. You know, it involves patient's discomfort, involves cost for a child. It involves sedation. If you're giving gadolinium, that's also something to be considered. And if you can decide which patient needs and which patient doesn't, I think it's very helpful. For example, in cluster 4, you probably can screen them much, much less often. I know right now our diagnostic surveillance and diagnostic criteria and recommendations are, you know, kind of variable and for everyone. I think this can help to tease apart which person needs what type of screening and which person needs early treatment for what. The second area I think this study would be very valuable is I'm hoping that tuberous sclerosis one day will see the light of some gene therapy studies, some other clinical trials of compound that can not only just treat symptoms but modify the course of the disease. And in that instance, studies like this or knowledge base like this will help us to select proper candidates. You want to select candidates for gene therapy or let's say for tumor therapy based on what their risk is. If you are in cluster 1, those would be appropriate to recruit for a TSC trial that's looking to treat tumors. If you are in cluster 3 and you want an intervention for autism and cognitive disability early life, that is the cluster to select phenotypically and genotypically. And I'm thinking that once we have these designer treatments that modify the course of the disease, maybe a gene therapy, maybe an ASO therapy, this type of studies can help us select proper candidates so we get good outcomes rather than just recruiting everybody for a trial in a disease that is so variable.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.